Florida lawmakers meet in the state capitol this week as local governments battle them for control. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, what you can expect from the 60-day legislative session starting today in Tallahassee. Lots to go into. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, some positive news and notes for your week. It's our What's Good Wednesdays. Plus, we'll mark Women's History Month with Teresa Miles of the Women's Center of Jacksonville. But first this hour, the latest numbers on the pandemic. The state reports that cases of COVID increased by over 7,000 yesterday. We are closing in on nearly 2 million cases since the pandemic began a year ago. Hospitalizations ticked down, but deaths rose by 136. The death toll in Florida now stands at 31,135 from the virus. And more than 3 million of you have had at least one dose of the vaccine so far. Speaking of vaccines, the new federal site at the Gateway Mall, which can handle up to 2,000 people a day, opened this morning. You don't need an appointment to get the shot at Gateway, but you are encouraged to register. Now, you're eligible to be vaccinated at Gateway if you meet these requirements. Everyone 65 and older. Also, if you're a healthcare worker, or if you are a K through 12 school staff, an educator or staffer age 50 or older, or if you are a member of law enforcement or a firefighter 50 years or older, you are now eligible to receive the vaccine for coronavirus. And as the 2021 Florida legislative session gets underway this week in Tallahassee, COVID relief naturally is at the top of the agenda for state lawmakers. But there are plenty of other issues on the list, including environmental concerns for Florida, particularly our vulnerability to climate change, flooding, and sea level rise. Lots to discuss, and we're pleased to welcome Susan Glickman. She's the Florida Director for the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, and she's on the line now. Hi, Susan. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good to have you on the show. And as we talk about the state's response to climate change and the upcoming legislative session, give us a call. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open. Well, Susan, as I mentioned, Florida faces a $2 billion budget gap for the upcoming fiscal year courtesy of the pandemic. So naturally, that is at the top of the lawmakers' agenda. But they are looking at a lot of other issues this spring legislative session. And somewhat surprisingly, for those of us who've watched them over many years, they're focusing on the environment. The governor is pitching $1 billion over 4 years to shore up state infrastructure against intensified storms, flooding, and sea level rise. House Speaker Chris Sprouse says this is a legislative priority. They're going to be looking at water quality and springs restoration efforts, too. It all sounds good, but of course, the devil is always in the details. So what are your thoughts about this effort to address resiliency and climate change for Florida?
It's very good that we're beginning to talk about the issues of climate change impacts such as sea level rise and chronic flooding. But I have to say right up front that you can't adapt your way out of this problem. If you only adapt to the climate impacts that are already in the pipeline, and we've seen sea level rise projections coming out of the NOAA data that has us as much as 2.5 feet of sea level rise just by mid-century, by 2050. So if you just prepare for that, but you don't also dramatically reduce the driver of the problem, which are the greenhouse gas emissions, then you'll just keep digging that hole. So it's very important, but it is a relief to hear state officials beginning to talk about what's ahead of us in Florida, because it's pretty scary stuff. And we need to be preparing, but we need to dramatically reduce our greenhouse gas emissions by moving to clean energy solutions and to stop just simply polluting. We can't do that, and everybody's sort of subsidizing people to pollute for free, right? And we're paying for it. So it's just really important that the state of Florida, you know, prepare for this. So it's there are two things going on, as you said. Speaker Chris Sprouse, who's from the Pinellas County area, was here last Friday, and he offered up $100 million to go through the Florida DEP to help regional planning councils and counties and local governments get prepared.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of local governments, nearly a dozen Florida cities have adopted a 100% clean energy mandate. Gainesville, Tallahassee, Orlando, South Miami, not Jacksonville, I should point out. And I know you want to talk about this because local governments are at odds with Tallahassee over these kinds of local measures to deal with climate change. You have a strong point of view about what you call preemption, the state preempting local municipalities. Can you tell us more about this?
Yes, it's really been a trend in recent years away from local control, where local governments, where the city of Jacksonville is going to actually determine, for instance, you know, where certain kinds of facilities are sited. So this session, we're seeing a number of these preemption bills that would take away local control from deciding, you know, certain decisions in the local community. So one of that is a state preemption of energy infrastructure regulations. So the idea would be that your local government wouldn't have any say whatsoever where energy infrastructure, that could be oil wells, it could also be solar panels or gas stations. It's incredibly broad, and you know, that's really deeply concerning. And I do think that you have the fossil fuel industry. We understand that what they call petroleum marketers, so the gas stations are concerned that as more and more communities adopt clean energy goals, that could get in the way of their continuing infrastructure, you know, or siting a pipeline for that matter, or fracking. So that's just one of the bills, but it's an example of what a lot of people really think is a shocking kind of power grab to take away any kind of local authority. It also works even with solar, that situation, because there are some local communities we're a big solar farm, and at Southern Electrical Energy, we support solar in a big way. We want to see lots of utility-scale solar. But, for instance, there was a community in Alachua County called Archer, historically a black community, and there was a proposal to put a big solar farm right in that community. And the locals did not want that. They were concerned about property values, and the Alachua County Commission turned it down. So now there is a bill in the legislature. It's Senate Bill 1008, and that's Senator Hudson, who's also got the energy infrastructure bill. And this would just allow solar just to go anywhere in rural agricultural areas without the local government weighing in. So again, that's a case-by-case basis. So I'm not suggesting that having solar in agriculture areas, you know, is a good thing or a bad thing. I think it's a good thing generally, but if that's not what the community wants, they ought to be able to weigh in there. So it's really, really important. And these kinds of decisions are going to be coming up more and more. You mentioned the dozen or so cities that have made 100% commitments. But just yesterday at the federal level, you know, President Biden committed to an 80% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2030 and 100% by 2035. So that will change a lot of kind of economics about the kinds of energy sources that we use, because once there becomes a value placed on this dangerous carbon pollution, then you'll get a more sort of equitable kind of market value for clean energy solutions. And becoming more efficient always was cheaper than building a power plant. So you're going to see a lot of change in trends. You know, a lot of the companies like Volvo and General Motors have just announced they're only going to put out electric cars. So we're really seeing some shifts here. But you cannot adapt your way out of climate change. You really, you know, have to make these reductions.
And it's your contention that the legislature, after many years of really refusing to acknowledge climate change even exists, they're now acknowledging it, but they're only looking at the adaptation side of it. Is that what I hear you saying? They're not looking at addressing the root causes of climate change.
Yes, that's exactly right. They're just talking about flooding and sea level rise, which would be adaptation. But yet some of these bills could make it harder for local governments to move plans forward. There's one bill about that would take away any decision-making authority about actually making these commitments to reducing greenhouse gas emissions. That's House Bill 617, and it gives complete authority to the Florida legislature. And so all these local governments are working very hard to become more efficient, to transition their fleets, to offer, you know, financing for solar and for energy efficiency in their communities, and the legislature wants to come in and preempt that. So it's there's a move toward building electrification. So the natural gas industry has bills, I believe it's 11 states now, again, that would take away the rights of local governments to decide how buildings are powered. So, again, across the country, people are moving away from sort of gas directly, you know, into buildings.
Yeah, sure.
Into electrification.
I got a news release just a few minutes ago from Florida Power and Light. They're installing 3 new electric vehicle fast charging stations in the Jacksonville area. That shows you which way the wind is blowing, everybody. But what are your questions for Susan Glickman? She's the Florida Director for the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. As we talk about the environment and energy concerns during the 60-day legislative session now underway in Tallahassee, Florida, the most vulnerable state in the union to the effects of climate change, flooding, and sea level rise. How should the state respond? What are your thoughts? 549-2937. Give us a call. Eric is in Arlington. Hi, Eric. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
All right. Thanks. Thanks for calling.
Okay. 3 points pretty quick. Number one, I'm against, absolutely against, giving any power whatsoever to the state to do anything. Anytime the state involves itself in anything, it turns into a disaster. And then what do? They turn around and blame the federal government. What we just saw in Texas was a result of mistakenly giving way too much power to the state. And
you mean the way Texas took itself off the federal energy grid and decided to go it alone, and that was a disastrous result?
Disaster, absolutely. And that's just one example. They're going to keep doing this over and over again. You know, there are all kinds of laws in Florida about, you know, dumping garbage and leavings from mining operations and so on out in the middle of nowhere. And then every once in a while, these piles get so big, they cave into an aquifer, and then it destroys the water for an entire this.
Oh, we lost your call, Eric. But Susan Glickman, you know, it's kind of funny. I tweeted this morning when we started the show that famous quote from a journalist and legislator from the 1800s, Gideon Tucker: "No man's life, liberty, or property are safe while the legislature is in session." It's a joke, but it kind of reflects the cynicism many people have about their state legislatures, which is certainly present here in Florida. So for people who don't have a lot of confidence in our state lawmakers to have a productive session, to pass bills that can actually protect the state, to get this right, what are your thoughts? What's your response to Eric?
Well, the legislators really need to hear from their constituents. They're very isolated up in Tallahassee. I know that's not too far from Jacksonville, but for the rest of the state. And historically, there were moves to move the state capitol closer to Orlando so more people could participate. And then this year in COVID, you're not even allowed to just be in the building in the same way that you have in years past. And I've been going to Tallahassee and to the legislature for decades myself, and you're isolated by going to the Leon County Civic Center a couple blocks away and testifying on camera. But that's going to make it very difficult to impact this process. So everyone needs to call their state legislators and tell them to stop the power grab, you know, stop the preempting of local governments, because the local governments, you know best what makes sense in their communities.
Yeah.
So this is a difficult year.
And by the way, it's not just environmental issues where you see this kind of preemption. Particularly in South Florida, the mayors down there, the leaders down there became very incensed with state government because they tried to enforce protections for the pandemic that were overruled as well, right?
That's right. And preemption as a tool isn't inherently a bad thing or a good thing, because some things do make sense to have a consistent law in a state as opposed to kind of a patchwork quilt. But this overuse of it, and it's interesting because typically it was thought of as a conservative notion to want local control. So to have a Republican leadership in Tallahassee trying to take away local control, last year there were 40, 50 local control type bills. So you just need to pick up that phone and call your legislator's office and say, you know, stop the power grab. It's the local governments that know their communities best. And on climate change, you know, we are in a perilous situation being in Florida, and I know people in the Jacksonville area have seen a lot of the flooding, and back when Hurricane Matthew came through, another example. And we're going to just see more of this extreme weather. We're seeing it all over the country with wildfires and, you know, extreme hurricanes. They're going to start hurricane season on May 15th instead of June 1st. So they're moving it up, and our temperatures are warming, the oceans are warmer. So we've got to get out in front of this and to do what we need to do to adapt the climate impacts that are already in the pipeline. And then we need to move dramatically. And as you mentioned, there's some very optimistic things. I do think the electrification of transportation, you know, is one of those things that it just moves the needle. We have more emissions coming out of the transportation sector than we do even power plants anymore, as the grid has gotten cleaner. And Consumer Reports says you can save $6,500 to almost $10,000 less on a comparable electric vehicle. And it's a really nice driving experience, not having to go to a gas station. But the incumbent industries that supply our power and petroleum, you know, they want to keep selling those products. And as I said, it's a very freeing thing. I have an electric vehicle, and I haven't been to a gas station in 2 years. And it's pretty exciting stuff.
Hey, if you're ever in Jacksonville, we have a couple of EV charging stations in our parking lot at WJCT now. And they are sprouting up all over town. 549-2937. Give us a call. Janet in St. Augustine. Hi, Janet.
Yes, good morning.
I'd
like for your guest to address the issue of the abandoned oil fields out in the Gulf of Mexico, oil rigs, I should say, in the Gulf of Mexico. They're emitting poisonous gases into the atmosphere, and I'd like that.
You're talking about the Deepwater Horizon spill?
No, just the abandoned oil rigs in the Gulf of Mexico.
Okay.
Are emitting poisonous gases into the atmosphere.
Thank you for that. And not really a topic for the legislative session, Susan, but it goes along with your message overall, that the world needs to shift for a number of reasons off fossil fuels.
Well, oil, petroleum is really a dirty business. And, you know, whether or not it's the Deepwater Horizon or just, spills and leaks during storms, even when, you know, the system is working, 80% of charging of electric vehicles happens at home. So, you know, it's a much sort of cleaner process and easier for people. And all the way through, whether, as the caller said, abandoned oil rigs, you know, this is a lot of pollution. And whether it's pollution, you know, that's changing the climate, or it's just more pollution in the Gulf of Mexico, that's getting into our sea life. And, you know, this is our economy in Florida, our beautiful beaches. And, of course, we all know that the Deepwater Horizon oil spill was such a disaster. So, you know, whether it's lesser amounts from abandoned oil rigs or, you know, a big spill like that, you know, it's just dirty. And it's, and then you have the climate impacts on top of that. I mean, think about the particulate matter coming out of tailpipes, and people who live near interstates and near road air pollution, you know, is a public health issue. And in a time of COVID, which is a respiratory virus, right, we want to all protect our public health. So by, you know, moving to electric vehicles and becoming more efficient and getting solar, we're really protecting our public health. We're creating local jobs. You know, Florida sends almost $64.5 billion out of state each and every year to bring in fossil fuel from elsewhere. So if you keep energy dollars here at home, you know, we're going to, you know, boost our local economies and create local jobs that you can't export anywhere.
It seems like such a common sense message. Vested interests, though, in this state and many others are holding back the kind of progress, the kind of transition you're talking about. Can you explain that in a little more detail, the dynamics in state capitals like Tallahassee?
Well, it's really all about money. It's money for campaign contribution money. It's money to political committees. It's money to hire hundreds of lobbyists who, you know, have connections and relationships or may even be family of lawmakers. I was reading just one article about the current president of the Senate and the Republic. They have their own sort of committees to make sure that the senators they want are elected and therefore will support them to become president of the Senate. And they do the same thing in the House, and we do this in Congress and legislatures all over. So the Senate committee for the Senate Republicans raised $38 million. And that number just really jumped out at me. $38 million to elect Senate, you know, Republicans. So whoever gives those that $38 million, you know, they do it, you know, with an intention in mind, right? They want to support their industry. And this is whether you're the insurance industry or it's the healthcare industry or it's utilities and oil companies. So it's across the board that we see this kind of influence. But when I was just reading an article and that number jumped out at me and I thought, well, you know, $38 million is a lot of money. And that's just one. And both political parties typically take this kind of corporate donation. So that's what it's all about. So you have industries like the oil industry that are very well-heeled, and they'll have their representatives talking to lawmakers at a time when it's very hard for public interest advocates to break through, especially with COVID. And I recognize that's just going to be unique this year, as we're all hoping.
Sure. Let me just get one more call on for you. Tom in Riverside.
Sure.
Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead, Tom.
Hey, yeah, I just wanted to say that I believe Ms. Glickman has really nailed on a couple of issues. On the environmental thing, but also on the preemption problem. Our government, state government, is controlled by the Republican Party, quote, the party of small government, and yet they're taking away powers, limiting powers of local government. And besides, you know, the energy issue, things like zoning, they put restrictions on what local governments can do to stop zoning violations. And as long as this, you know, continues, I see us, you know, not making any progress as a state, as a city here in Jacksonville.
Tom, thanks. You know, Susan, in Jacksonville in recent years, the city council here has gotten religion on this topic. They have a committee looking at how to better protect the city. They're going to be hiring a chief resiliency officer. Better late than never. But for Florida as a whole, time is of the essence, isn't it? This state is incredibly vulnerable. And a new analysis put out this week by the First Street Foundation finds that Florida cities, more than any other in the country, are going to face enormous impacts from flooding, and people's property values are going to plummet in coastal areas across the state.
Well, and when property values plummet, that means revenues to local governments are going to be lowered at a time when they're going to need you know, to pay for certain kinds of infrastructure investments. And I'm very happy to see Jacksonville has been obviously following and being supportive of efforts there. There are regional resilience coalitions around the state, even up in the Panhandle, a new Appalachian resilience coalition has just formed. So this is part of the problem about all this preemption. So when you have local governments that know, you know, what needs to happen in their communities, and then you go to the state level, it's just easier to go to Tallahassee, where a very small number of people are really making all those decisions. They decide whether a piece of legislation even gets heard or not, right? So it's very concentrated. And then they take away the authority, because it's harder if you're, you know, you don't want a preemption on plastic bags or styrofoam, or even in Key West, they passed the legislation about sunscreen and a certain kind of sunscreen that had chemicals, which they believe to be hurting the coral reefs. So it's sort of easier for these interests just to go to one place, kind of one-stop shopping, and take away that control. So Jacksonville, when it decides to create any number of plans to adapt to climate impacts in the pipeline and to reduce emissions so we don't make it worse, you know, they might be thwarted by what's going on in Tallahassee, because they may just take away their right to make greenhouse gas reduction plans. I mean, that is in one of the bills, the House Bill 617 on greenhouse gas emissions, limiting local government's ability. So they're not doing their job. The reason these regional resiliency coalitions have formed is because the state, and up until now, for the last 8 years, the federal government have abdicated their responsibility to be out in front. And in large part, it's due to the influence of these fossil fuel industries. Again, it's the same way as the insurance industry, you know, and other industries in this country that have enormous influence. But, you know, it's one thing to, you know, pass on costs to people. It's quite another thing to alter the climate of the planet. And this is going to, you know, just be such a serious endeavor, you know, into the future. And whether it's the sea level rise or higher temperatures or mosquito-borne diseases or the just increasingly extreme weather that we're seeing all over the country, you know, we just cannot afford any more inaction.
Any more inaction.
It costs less to act than not.
And I want to thank you so much. Susan Glickman with us today, the Florida Director for the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, as the legislative session kicks off this week in Tallahassee. Susan, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Melissa.
And more about these issues at our website, adaptflorida.org. Later, some good news for your midweek. It's our What's Good Wednesdays. That's later in the hour. But up next.
They started with just information and referral in a one-room house in Riverside. We now have two buildings, 42 employees, and a budget of close to $3 million.
This Women's History Month, we mark the growth of the Women's Center of Jacksonville as they rebrand. We'll be right back. Well, March is Women's History Month, and the leading women's shelter and advocacy center in the city has much planned, including a rebranding and a partnership with all of the female mayors out at the beaches. Teresa Miles is executive director of the Women's Center of JAX, or WCJ, and I spoke with her. Take a listen. Hi, Teresa. Good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Melissa. Always wonderful to be with you.
So it's Women's History Month. Let's share a little history first off about the Women's Center of Jacksonville, the story of this organization and this community and what you're doing now.
Sure, absolutely. Well, thanks for asking. So 25 years we have been, well, we're going on our 26th year. So last year we had a huge celebration of our 25th year. Of course, it was a little non-traditional when you look at where we are all in the middle of a worldwide pandemic, but we celebrated. We celebrated our 25th year as well as the ratification of the 19th Amendment, providing for women the right to vote. So it was a pretty amazing year. And when you think about where we started, a lot of sacrificial women came together and knew that there were gaps in services in our community, primarily in the area for women. You know, they didn't have a centralized location in which to find the help that was necessary. So my predecessor and the founder of the organization, Shirley Webb, you know, was really instrumental in getting the Women's Center started and all the women that surrounded her in order to do so. And they started with just information and referral in a one-room house in Riverside. And from there, a little bit of an expansion, and that's now the Jasmine House down there in Riverside. So they expanded into another facility that we have here in Arlington now, which is where our primary offices are, and we do our counseling services and our education. And then in 2017, as you know, we expanded to providing sexual assault forensic exams in a facility off of Emerson Street. So we now have two buildings, 42 employees, and a budget of close to $3 million.
Wow, incredible growth.
It was a, volunteer organization with no budget at the beginning.
Yeah. So, well, the need was obviously there. You're also the only certified rape crisis center in Duval County. Mm-hmm. And so,
that's correct. Duval, Nassau, and Baker. Yeah.
Duval, Nassau, and Baker. So in this pandemic, how much more critical have your services become for women in this area?
It has been interesting. Just the journey in and of itself, we had originally anticipated seeing a tremendous spike in the number of sexual assaults, and we actually saw a little bit of the opposite, where we and JSO saw a decrease in the number of reported sexual assaults. And really reaching out to my colleagues in the state, we found that to be the same. Down in Miami-Dade, I believe it was 65% decrease. And what we really were able to learn from that is that so many individuals who were sexually assaulted were frightened to go into an emergency department and did not know what to do. We have gotten where we are back up in our numbers, unfortunately, as we have moved toward, you know, vaccine and maybe people feeling a little bit more safer about coming forward. But where we saw our greatest amount of growth was in our counseling services and the number of people who reached out to us. We hit an all-time high. Last year, we had almost 325 new clients in our counseling department. And, Melissa, we've got less than four FTEs. So
FTEs,
really,
meaning?
I'm sorry, full-time employees who are providing those services to individuals. And, you know, primarily we focus on sexual assault and trauma. And it was a pretty daunting time for our therapists. We went to remote, so we were able to provide those services remotely. We moved back into our offices in October, and we really are continuing to provide a hybrid model, if you will. So individuals who need the remote counseling would like to continue with that. We have that available. And, you know, a lot of our individuals will come to us because they need a safe space. So we want to make certain that that's available as well.
Yeah. So trauma, this whole ordeal has been traumatic for so many, but women especially. As we come out of this time, tell us a little bit about your agenda for the rest of the year at the Women's Center.
Well, we've got some exciting things going on, which we'll be kind of launching next week, which is a new look. We have changed our logo, as you all have as well. It's an exciting time for your station and all the work that's being done there. But we are really going to be launching a new look that really is more encompassing of how we work at the intersection of women and trauma and women and poverty and all of the things that impact women's lives, as well as the men that we are serving and those non-gender individuals who are being sexually assaulted as well, so that they know they have a safe place to come. When you see our logo, it will no longer be, you know, the women's head or the women's center is prominent. It'll be WCJ. You know, we really want people to understand that we're going to be here and they need to be able to approach us regardless of their gender. So we're looking at that as a real focus moving forward, just how we rebrand ourselves and how we continue to support the community with the services we've always provided, but also kind of reaching out to people where they're at, the marginalized individuals in our community, you know, that intersection of color, education, class, age, ability, all of those things that can marginalize women.
Yeah. And then with the gender identity stuff, have you seen an increase in people who fall into that category seeking you out?
We have. We absolutely have. And, you know, we've also done some outreach because we want individuals of all genders to come to us and know that this is a safe environment. So, yeah, we have. We've been serving some of the individuals in the transgender community as well as non-binary individuals, and just trying to do our best to provide a service where there is a need. You know, when you look back at our history, we were here to fill a gap, and we feel as though that's still our role, if there is a need, we want to be able to support it if it's aligned with our mission.
Yeah, I wanted to let you know that we are partnering with our beaches, with Mayor Chris Hoffman, Mayor Ellen Glasser, and Mayor Elaine Brown, our three female mayors over on the beaches, to really push for destigmatizing sexual assault and doing those prevention services that we know could make a difference. We are looking at launching this on March 30th, Three Beaches, One Mission, End Sexual Assault. So we will be doing a press conference at 10 a.m. on the 30th at Latham Plaza, and our goal is to get as many people out there as possible. We are going to blanket the beaches with posters and items and things that we hope will get the message out, along with our hotline number, so people know how they can reach us 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, 904-721-7273. And that's going to be a big part of our coming out of Women's History Month and moving into our Sexual Assault Awareness Month in April.
Excellent. Thank you so much. She's Teresa Miles, Executive Director of the Women's Center of Jacksonville, online at thewcj.org.
Thank you, Melissa. Always nice talking with you.
Well, speaking of Women's History Month, there will be a drive-in screening of the documentary film Knock Down the House coming up this Saturday at the beaches. Brianna Kilcullen is the founder and CEO of the local activist brand Enact. They are sponsoring this screening, and she's on the line. Brianna, good morning.
Good morning. Hi, how are you?
I'm great, thanks. Good to talk to you. You know, I caught this film, I think, on Netflix a year or so ago. Knock Down the House is about a number of women, four women, and their fight to become elected to Congress, including, of course, AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Tell us a little bit about this event and why you're screening Knock Down the House.
Yeah, so I saw the screening a year ago, and I remember when I watched it, I was so inspired by just the grit that all of those women have, and really shedding light on how to organize a campaign, how to fundraise. And I feel like coming off of the 2020 election, which was incredibly contentious, that, you know, we should be doing the work now to inspire the next generation that they can run, and that you don't have to have a perfect pedigree to run for office. And so I think that a lot of people think, oh, I have to go to this school, or I have to, you know, have a bank account and this amount of money in order to run. And so I wanted to screen Knock Down the House so that people knew that anything was possible and to be inspired, because I think people are struggling right now. We need a light, and we should be electing people who represent the community and letting know that next generation that they're capable and that they can run too.
It's interesting that just as we speak about this, I'm looking at trending topics on Twitter. AOC is trending on Twitter right now with a tweet calling for this nation to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. That is a conversation this country is having right now. And so this is a drive-in movie screening coming up Saturday night, March 6th, 6 o'clock at the Seahorse Hotel parking lot, $20 per vehicle. And this is a way for you to participate civically, but also talk about Enact and what you do with Enact. Tell us a little bit about the mission of Enact.
Yeah, so it's interesting that, you know, I grew up here in Jacksonville, and then I left and worked in corporate for a large apparel brand. And so when I moved home, I think, you know, being in textiles and also being an e-commerce brand and a brand that stands for something and has a movement have been really kind of new conversations and new things that I've had to kind of pioneer here in Jacksonville. And so with Enact, like for me, I felt like after the 2016 election, I remember driving back from LA to San Diego and just crying the entire way and wondering how can all of this happen? And I had this realization that like, if anyone can, you know, run and do this, then like, so can I. And how do I hold myself accountable to that? And so with Enact, it's really about what actions can we take? What simple act can I take and inspire others to take each day, you know, to make the world a better place? And I know that's a very big concept, but I feel like it starts with just these small acts. And so we're pretty bold and really trying to shed light on different topics that a lot of people don't want to talk about. So it's not just, hey, we sell sustainable towels. We're making sustainable towels because this is the action that I know to take within the industry that I came from. But we also want to connect with other change makers and what they're doing, you know, and all the different spheres of influence, because I think it takes all of us here in our local community. It can't just, you know, be one person, or especially if we just elect one person to think they're going to carry everything. So that's really where the inspiration comes from.
It's Women's History Month, and as we speak with Brianna Kilcullen, the founder and CEO at Enact, their ACT UP series returns this Saturday with a drive-in screening of Knock Down the House at the Beaches. We have a giveaway, everybody. Yes, it's been a while since we've done one of those. We have a free entry for one vehicle to the Saturday night drive-in screening of Knock Down the House. That's a $20 value. If you want to grab that ticket, email us now at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. We will pick one winner at random. Again, this is Saturday night in the Seahorse Hotel parking lot. The film begins at 6:30. So send us those emails now. And what's next in your series after this weekend, Brianna?
Yeah, so we did, this is our second drive-in event. So our last one in October, we screened Good Hair to raise awareness around women of color and stigmas around getting to rock their natural hair and crown. And so we really want to focus, you know, on things that resonate with the community and impact us. So April is actually Fashion Revolution Month, so we want to do a screening on textiles and then just continue to build, and especially the drive-ins are great, you know, for COVID, that we can create this safe space where we can all learn and educate and connect with people who are actually doing stuff here in the community to make it a better place. So if you ever have ideas, let me know.
Well, I appreciate your time. Again, it's a screening Saturday night of Knock Down the House at the Beaches, $20 per vehicle. Check it out at the Seahorse Hotel parking lot over at the Beaches Town Center. And thank you, Brianna Kilcullen, founder and CEO at Enact here in Jacksonville. Thanks so much. Have fun.
Thank you, Melissa.
That screening, by the way, is in collaboration with the Seahorse Oceanfront Inn, the UNF Center for Entrepreneurship and Innovation, the Lemon Bar, and Sight and Sound Productions. A quick break, and in a moment, some positive news and notes for your midweek. It's our What's Good Wednesdays. Everything from the symphony to a 5K downtown and more happening this weekend. We'll round it all up for you right after this. You're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9. Don't go away.
Announcing Vickers Landing at Oak Bridge, bridging retirees with an all-new Ponte Vedra Beach community featuring new homes, a resort lifestyle, and a life plan for every stage of aging. Information at vickerslanding.com. Congareen Pen, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering field-to-fork dining and outdoor experiences on over 300 acres. Sip, dine, explore. Information at congareenpen.com.
It's the first Florida legislative session to take place during a pandemic in modern times. And every weeknight during this unique session, Capitol Report will keep you informed on what happens, the people, the politics, and the pandemic throughout the 2021 Florida lawmaking session on Capitol Report.
Tonight at 6:30 on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, Lee Isaac Chung, writer and director of the new film Minari, about a family of South Korean immigrants trying to make it in rural America in the 80s. It's based partly on Chung's own experiences. It won a grand jury prize at Sundance and just won the Golden Globe for Best Foreign Language Film. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
To quote a great American composer, music can name the unnameable and communicate the unknowable. But music education is in decline. Many students pass through school without ever having picked up an instrument. Who's making the discipline a priority? And what impact does music education have on our youngest minds? Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
I know, you would think. Welcome back. It's a new month, and we've got a new slate of exciting events creeping back onto the local social calendar. COVID safe, of course, and personally approved by our committee here at the station. That's actually a committee of two people, myself and producer Heather Schatz. Yes, it's Wednesday. Time for our weekly look at what's good around the First Coast. Some positive news for your midweek. We hope you like these suggestions for your Saturday and Sunday, whatever you do this weekend. Get out and enjoy it. And this weekend is a big one for the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra. Their virtual gala fundraiser is set for this Friday night. And then on Saturday, fans will be able to attend an in-person live gala concert. It features a performance by famed pianist Jean-Yves Thibaudet. And I learned more about all of the excitement at the symphony coming up this weekend when I spoke to conductor and music director Courtney Lewis.
So this weekend is our annual gala, and because of COVID, we're doing things slightly differently this year. So on Friday night at 7:30, we're having a virtual gala fundraiser, and that includes a virtual silent auction and a one-hour event highlighting how the Jacksonville Symphony has impacted our community recently. There are speeches by me, Jean-Yves Thibaudet, the guest pianist, Stephen Libman, the CEO, and that's free and open to the public online. Then on Saturday night, we're having a live concert, which features a performance by Jean-Yves Thibaudet, who's one of the most famous pianists alive today. He's playing Ravel's wonderful jazz-inspired G major piano concerto, and that's with me and the symphony. And that event is ticketed, and there are still a few seats available for that if you are interested in coming. Both these events together are one of our most important fundraisers for the whole year, and they benefit the symphony and all our various programs. It's great. I mean, we're so lucky in Jacksonville because, you know, there are only a handful of orchestras in America that are performing at the moment. And there is an even smaller handful that's actually performing in front of a live audience. There's only five orchestras. So that's really something special that we have in Jacksonville.
It really is. You know, it's been a long, hard year without much at all in the way of live performances. So all hail the symphony. Wear your masks, of course. All COVID safety protocols will be followed. You can get your tickets now at jackssymphony.org. Well, lace up your sneaks and hit the pavement downtown this weekend. It's the fifth annual Move It 5K, sponsored by Calford Chop House and supporting JAMS, the Jacksonville Art and Music School. It's a creative youth development organization that provides arts education and leadership development to students grades 3 through 10 from underserved communities. This year's 5K is more vital than ever, says Calford Chop House CEO and co-owner Jacques Klempf. JAMS, like so many other nonprofits, really has needed extra support. in this pandemic and recession. So register now for the Move It 5K and the 1 mile fun run. You can go to firstplacesports.com and register, and come on out for that this weekend in downtown Jacksonville. All you runners and all you walkers out there, a great outdoor activity, COVID safe, and get some exercise. Now, also this weekend, you can support the local community of those who have intellectual and developmental differences, or IDDs. And all you have to do for this is go shopping. Yes. Now, this is part of what is called the Connectable movement, ABLE being the key part of Connectable. They've launched a new initiative this week, and it's called Shop Ability. Again, ability, the key part of that word. And it's all designed to shine a light on local businesses that employ people with autism, Down syndrome, and other IDDs. Connectable Jax unveiled a searchable interactive map this month, and it charts hundreds of IDD-inclusive businesses across the First Coast. I spoke with their director, Sarah Stroop, yesterday right here on this show.
Shopability Saturday is a citywide celebration of inclusive employers. We are inviting our whole community to shop or support businesses that choose to see the abilities of people with autism, Down syndrome, and other intellectual and developmental differences, and just celebrate their contributions in the workplace. We have a map of close to 150 businesses across Jacksonville that employ or provide internship opportunities for people with intellectual and developmental differences, or IDDs, and it's at connectablejacks.com.
Check that out, connectablejacks.com/shopability. A compassionate genius idea that we love here on the show. And if you have something you love, share it with us. Email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org so we can try to spotlight your spark of positive every Wednesday. And subscribe to our What's Good Wednesday free e-newsletter, which goes out later today. And that is our show. Thanks for listening, and thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is show director. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo. Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. And if you missed any part of today's show, our podcast is up later today, wherever you like to listen. You can also listen through the WJCT app. Download that for lots of great content delivered straight to you. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.